About a year ago, in connection with the seminars, I did quite a bit of reading on the Olivet Prophecy. And I found it helpful that simply to take the order of events as each gospel records them, and then sort of synchronize them together to get was the way to get the fullest understanding. The reason the three gospel writers wrote the Lord's message in answer to the disciples' three questions, and they came at it with different perspectives. In fact, the four gospels have been likened, haven't they, to the four faces of the cherubim. Not all of them cover everything, but what they did write was by inspiration and in orderly sequence. We know that that is true of the events of the crucifixion and the resurrection. You get that fullest picture when you relate the events and find the time sequence, and putting them all together, we get as complete a picture of what happened. It's as if we were then there listening to the Lord as he spoke, as near as we can 2,000 years later. Now, I came to the question, is that the way to read all of the Gospels? And I put it to you that it is. We have the 3.5 years ministry of the Lord, and if we, in the same way, synchronize the Gospels together, a harmony of the Gospels, if you like, and so read them, we will have the fullest picture. So in fact, what I began to do about that time, forgotten to bring it up, but I had a 1B5 exercise book, and I created four columns, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And effectively, what I then put in was four rows. And those four rows were the events of the four Passovers, which it is not difficult to define and see where they fit. From then on, and this is where a computer is handy, a spreadsheet, I started to list the events in each of the segments up until the first Passover in the Lord's ministry, and then between the first and the second Passovers, and the third and fourth, and so on. And so I created my own harmony of the Gospels, effectively. And I found that very helpful to me personally in coming to know and relate the events together. And can I suggest to you that you might find it a very helpful project as you do the readings to create that simple harmony. You don't necessarily need a computer. You can do it by hand. I remember some years ago, Jeannie found information about her family history, her family tree, and by taking a trip to a registrar's office in the UK, she was able to access records, and she started to build up on a piece of paper what she had gathered. And from then on, she was able to get more and more information by further research. And piece of paper got added to piece of paper and stuck together and so on. Doesn't matter how you do it. You can do that with the Gospels without a computer, that's the point. It gives purpose as you read. And you'll be amazed at what comes out. You're in a better position to relate pieces of information recorded by the Gospels together to see where they fit. And it helps fill out context and appreciate what is going on at the time. We read of the journeys of the Apostle Paul, don't we? His three journeys and then his trip to Rome. What about the Lord's journeys as he travelled around over that 3.5 years in his ministry? It helps build that picture up. And so, as I say, I started to piece together this harmony of the Gospels, keeping strictly to the order of the events given, because I think that is a clue. Not deviating from the order given one iota. And I emphasize that because it's different from the approach that many have taken as they have pieced together their harmony of the Gospels. There's oodles of these harmonies available, and I'm convinced that many of them are not right, because what they seem to have done is to have, when they read of a particular event, and we're going to look at one in a minute, the healing of the centurion's servant, for example, immediately they find that in another gospel they say, the same event. And it's not always the case. And from then on, of course, what they have done, it sort of gave ground to the higher critics of perhaps 100 years ago or less, this business of noting the discrepancies and the differences to be found between the records, it gave them field days to then cast aspersions on the authenticity of the Gospels and tearing them apart. And that is not helpful to faith. And so, in commending to you this exercise, if you haven't done it already, it's not just an academic exercise for the scholarly. We're all fellow disciples, fellow learners, desiring to be more worthy and more committed as we seek to follow the Lord. And so what I'm saying, I guess, is that, amongst other things, in the Gospels, in each one of the Gospels, we have a chronology, a sequential history of the events of the Lord's ministry. And broadly, there is nothing out of order, as we all know. We're looking at the inspired writings, the Holy Scriptures, not flawed in any way. Last week in the psalm reading, as we read here, there was a lovely last verse in Psalm 93. Lord, your testimonies are completely reliable. And that's certainly the case as we look at the Gospels. I asked myself in the process of all this, why 3.5 years? And of course, we're all aware that that time period occurs on a number of occasions in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. We have it in the ministry of Elijah. It's there in Daniel in the last period of 7 years, which is split in half, 2 periods of 3.5 years. We have it with the two witnesses in Revelation chapter 11. And then, of course, with creation, we have the complete 7, with it being completed with the 7th day of rest. God's work finished to his satisfaction. So it occurs to me that in the Lord's 3.5 year ministry, where his work is suddenly and abruptly terminated, it is only part finished. When he fought and destroyed sin in himself, And he established the new covenant, the way of reconciliation. But what about the world that he came to save? We see not yet all things subdued under him. The work is only part done. So, as we say, most events in the Gospels line up as we would expect. But there are surprises. And I just want to look at one of those surprises in the centurion's servant healing. And we'll see what we can gain from that. As we contemplate the Gospel just one little bit further, of course we remember that Matthew and John were eyewitness disciples. They were both there throughout the ministry of the Lord. Luke, as a doctor, a Greek-speaking doctor, says that at the beginning it seemed good to him, as he wrote to Theophilus, since I have carefully investigated everything from the very first to write to you in orderly sequence. There is another translation of that, which I think is better, where he says, since I have perfect understanding of all things from above. It is that word that John uses in his Gospel with Nicodemus when he says he must be born from above, not simply again, to write to you in orderly sequence. So there's the standing of the Gospel writings. So from this chart, from this spreadsheet that I had built up, I started relating events together surrounding the healing of the centurion's servant. And we can do a similar exercise relating to the storm on the lake and the Gadarene demoniac, on the woman with the issue and the raising of Jairus' daughter. What I'm saying to you is in principle the same there as well. So we have a record of the healing of the centurion servant in Matthew chapter 8, and we have it also in Luke chapter 7. And I want to say to you first of all that when I look at the Matthew chapter 8 one, that occurred between the first and the second of the Passovers in the Lord's ministry. But when I look at the Luke 7 one, that occurred between the second and the third Passovers. So straight away, either you look for discrepancies, as so many of the critics have done, or you have to say, now wait a minute, they can't both be the same incident if they happened at different times. And then you know that the contexts surrounding these healings are different. For example, the Matthew record follows the Sermon on the Mount, which is Matthew 5, 6 and 7. And then following that, Jesus cleanses a leper. And then he enters Capernaum, and we're into the centurion incident. If you look at the Luke reading, the Luke record, the context is the sermon, yes, but it's not the Sermon on the Mount. It's the sermon that the Lord delivers on a plain. And then you look at what happens after the incident, as both of them record it. In Matthew, the Lord stayed in Capernaum. Many were healed, including Peter's wife's mother. And then there are all those sunset healings that we just sang about, when in the evening before the sun did set, all those were brought to him and they were healed. Whereas in the Luke incident, the Lord leaves Capernaum after the healing of the centurion's servant, and he goes to Nain, where he raised the widow's son as he was on the open coffin being carried out of the town. So there is complete support there for them being different incidents. Now, to look at them, the comparisons are that in both of them they happened in Capernaum. In Matthew, "Lord, my servant lying at home," says the centurion, "paralyzed in terrible agony." Jesus says, "I will come and heal him." The response of the centurion, who I'm sure was a Gentile, a Roman centurion, "I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof. Say the word only. I also am a man under authority." The amazement of Jesus, "I've not found anyone in Israel with so great a faith." And he says to him, "Go, as you have believed, let it be done for you." And the servant was cured that very moment. In the second one, which, as I'm saying, happened probably a year later, again Jesus enters Capernaum. There is note by the writer Luke of the centurion's slave being highly valued, sick and about to die. The comparison is the same, sick and about to die. But, verse 3 of Luke 7, "when the centurion heard of Jesus, he sent Jewish elders to come and save the life of the slave." It's different, isn't it? He doesn't come himself. And then the elders take up his plea. And they say, "He is worthy, he loves our nation. He's built us our synagogue." And verse 6, "Jesus went with them," the Jewish elders, not with the centurion. "And when he was near the house, the centurion sent friends with the message, 'Lord, don't trouble yourself, since I'm not worthy to have you under my roof.'" The comparison between the two centurions, two Gentiles, is there. And he sent the message via those friends that he sent to Jesus, "That's why I didn't come to you. But say the word, and my servant will be cured." And again, the amazement of Jesus. "And when those who had been sent returned to the house of the centurion, they found the slave in good health." Again, Jesus had healed without actually visiting the bedside. Now, I looked at the events surrounding this, and I found that just before all of this had happened, back in John chapter 4, is recorded the healing of the nobleman's son. It's in John chapter 4, starting at verse 46. And let's just pick this up. "Then Jesus went again to Cana of Galilee," his second visit to Cana, "where he had turned the water into wine. There was a certain royal official there whose son was ill at Capernaum. I have royal official, you would probably have nobleman. Whether he was a Gentile or a Jew, I'm not sure that we can be sure. I'm not sure. When this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea into Galilee, he went to him and pleaded with him to come down and heal his son, for he was about to die. So Jesus had just come back from Jerusalem, and you find that that is after the first Passover. And of course on the way he'd come via Samaria, and we know the incident of the woman at the well at Sychar. Jesus told him, the nobleman, unless you people see signs and wonders, you will not believe. Sir, the official said to him, come down before my boy dies. Go, Jesus told him, your son will live. The man believed what Jesus said to him and departed. While he was still going down, his slaves met him, saying that his boy was alive. He asked them at what time he'd got better. The father realized this was the very hour at which Jesus had told him, your son will live. Then he himself believed the second belief statement, along with his whole household. So this event happened just before the event recorded by Matthew of the healing of the centurion. And Capernaum is common to all three. You have to picture, don't you, the working of the grapevine in Capernaum. Newspapers make it happen today, and other media. But it would have been just as powerful in those days. An important event takes place. One who is dying has their life restored, and everyone is talking about it. The nobleman who had fetched Jesus, or tried to fetch him from Cana, to come to Capernaum, and all that had happened with the healing of the nobleman's son, the grapevine would have it working. And the fact that Jesus hadn't even come, he'd healed at a distance. And it's as if this centurion picks up on all of these things. And apart from his own Gentiledom, his own unworthiness to come near this man, he knows already that he is healed from a distance. He doesn't need the Lord to come. And the second one, knowing that a centurion had been healed, likewise, his faith was such that he believed in the limitless power of the Lord to do this. Well, following the second one, the raising of the widow of Nain's son, of course you see the link, don't you? We have three who have been sick, so sick, about to die at the point of death, and the Lord has healed them. And now he is about to enter into Nain, where one who has died is being carried out. He's able even to raise the dead. And then after the widow of Nain incident, we have recorded by Luke the interview with John's disciples when John from prison had sent them and asked, are you the one who is to come, or are we still looking for another? And to those two disciples, the Lord said, go and report to John what you've heard and seen. And all of this that we've been talking about would come into what they reported. Capernaum, we say. In Israel, they say Kfar Nahum, which literally is the village of Nahum. Whether it was the birthplace or the town of the prophet Nahum, I'm not sure, but what I do know is that Nahum means comfort, consolation. Oh, and the comfort and the consolation. These, the nobleman, the two centurions, and all of those who at sunset were lying there and were healed, what they received was consolation indeed. And in fact, as you look at it, the amount of healing work that the Lord did in Capernaum was massive. Immediately after the Lord had spoken to with John's disciples, this is what we have in Matthew chapter 11. Then Jesus proceeded to denounce the towns where most of his miracles were done, because they did not repent. All of this massive healing, yes, it was interesting, but it was in line with what the Lord said. You come to me because you want to see the signs and the wonders that are done. But it didn't seem to go on inside them and speak to their personal needs, even though they might be well. Woe to you, Chorazin, which is a town just a few miles away. Woe to you, Bethsaida. Again, in another direction, a few miles away from Capernaum. For if the miracles that were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented. And then verse 23. And you, Capernaum, Kfar Nahum, will you be exalted to heaven? You will go down to Hades. For if the miracles that were done in you had been done in Sodom, it would have remained until today. It would have impacted on those people such that they would have repented and turned. I tell you, it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom on the day of judgment than for you, Capernaum. And so we've seen this tremendous, all-embracing healing work of the Lord in Capernaum. The three who we've seen at the point of death, and apart from the many of in their diverse needs, as we say. And we've seen a young man dead with his heartbroken mother, healed and raised. The Gospels have to transform us, brothers and sisters. The message has to leap out of the page. And we have to be there. We have to feel it. Otherwise, we're no different to the Capernaums.